Welcome to episode 594 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a Top Cow Thursday episode, and today we're going to be talking about an upcoming title from Top Cow that has me really excited. I got a chance to read the first issue, and it's really, really great. When I first heard about the premise, I was excited, and we'll talk a little bit about why that is in a minute. But then when I read the first issue, it really even exceeded my expectations, both in pacing, which I, as you know, if you listen to the podcast for any period of time, is always what I think is the hardest thing to get right in comics, and both visually. It's a really solid story. So it's the title is Freeze, and I'm lucky enough to be joined by the creative team from The Freeze, Dan Wickline and Philip Sevi. Welcome to the show, guys. Thanks a lot for joining me.
Thank you for having us.
Well, yeah, thanks for having us.
So before we get into the title itself, Philip's been on the show before, but Dan, this is your first time, but I want to give you both a chance to kind of introduce yourselves and maybe let us know some previous work that you've done that our listeners may be familiar with. And if you want, you can even mention if you grew up reading comics and how you got started in creating comics.
Okay. I've been reading comics since I was 5 years old, which for a lot of the readers here is like, you know, BC. But I, you know, started off, my uncle bought me a comic and I ended up getting into buying them on a regular basis. I went to my first convention when I was 11 and I got to meet Jack Kirby,
wow,
Carolyn Monroe, and Walter Koenig on the same day, which pretty much set me on a path to pop culture and wanting to be a comic book writer from that point forward. And just got into comics in the late, you know, wanted to do my own comics for a long time, but started actually publishing in the late 90s and went freelance in the early 2000s. Have worked for just about everybody but Marvel and DC at this point. I've done some Grim Fairy Tales and Sinbad work for Zenoscope. I've worked on the 30 Days of Night series for IDW. I brought back the original Shadowhawk for Jim Valentino. I've been all over the place doing different books. I've done some work for Top Cow previously on their Artifact series and their I did Artemis, Artemis one shot, and now I'm doing the Freeze.
Awesome, and you you have some novels that have that you've published as well, right?
Yeah, I've done. I've got a series of urban fantasy novels based on a character named Lucius Fogg, and there's three of them out so far. They're all on Amazon, both Kindle, print, and I have somebody recording the first one right now for audio.
Oh, awesome!
So that should be out early next year. And I've also just finished a Patreon-based novel. A vigilante that rises up in the town of Blythe, California, which is is kind of a twisted, dark, fun story. So that should be out soon as well.
Oh, that's interesting. But yeah, Blythe, I live in Phoenix. So anytime I drive back to California, I always drive through Blythe. It's a different place, I'll say that. It's got its own...
Yeah, the whole idea was coming back from the Phoenix Comic Con and my girlfriend and I driving through Blythe and she looks around, she's like, where are we? And yeah. I'm like, oh, that's Blythe. She goes, it's kind of an S-hole. And I went, yeah.
Yeah.
And by the time I got back to LA, I had a whole story in mind based off of that line.
That's awesome. What about you, Philip? You know, we've had you on the show before. You've talked about your work on Tithe and Tomb Raider. What else have you been up to?
So probably since the last time I was on, I finished up my run on Tomb Raider. I did about 12 issues with Mariko Tamaki. And then I had a couple of creator-owned projects out after that. One was Paradox, which was a sci-fi one-shot that I wrote and drew just after I finished Tomb Raider as a fun thing, just to kind of shake the creative gears loose. And then I ended up kickstarting it and publishing that. And then after that, The House is a 7-issue World War II horror series that I wrote and worked on with artist Drew Zucker. We worked on that for about 7 years before it saw Stop publishing. It came out last year via Comixology, and then we did another Kickstarter at the end of the year and printed a trade. We got about a 200-page trade of that. Once that wrapped up, I started on a new Tomb Raider miniseries, which is Tomb Raider Inferno, with writers Jackson Lansing and Colleen Kelly. That just finished up about a month ago. It was a 4-issue mini, and also The Freeze, which we're here to talk about. So kept pretty busy, my best I can do since we last chatted.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's great to hear when good people are you know, like we talked about before we started recording, you know, getting to do your dream job as your day job. It's just awesome. So congrats on that.
Yeah, it is. Thanks.
Well, let's get to the main course here, The Freeze, the book we're here to talk about. Let's let our listeners know kind of what the elevator pitch is. What's Freeze all about?
Okay, the short version is guy goes to work one day, climbs under his desk to plug in a power strip. When he gets back up, the people all around him are not moving. They're completely frozen, not cold frozen, but they're not moving. He starts walking around the office trying to see what's going on. More and more he sees nobody's moving. He looks out the big window in the conference room and sees the streets of LA below, and there's car crashes and flames and just chaos, but nobody's moving. And he realizes he's the only person on the planet that's moving.
Well,
yet he also discovers that he has the ability to unfreeze people.
Yeah. So it's an interesting concept, right? It's not exactly pressing, you know, pause on your DVR or whatever, because obviously cars, you know, kept in motion and, you know, things like that. But yeah, everybody's frozen. So now what, right?
Exactly. That's the whole thing, is that what do you do at that point? I mean, it's basically time to rebuild society, because the idea that, you know, one person, he's the only person with that ability, so he can't really run around and touch everybody to unfreeze them.
Yeah.
There's only so many people you could do that to, and who do you unfreeze becomes the big question as well.
Yeah, because, I mean, in what order do you, because obviously there's going to be chaos as far as, you know, car crashes and infrastructure and all kinds of stuff like that. So it's like, where do you start? And you're just one guy.
Exactly.
So,
plus,
go ahead.
I would say, plus he learns pretty quickly on that unfreezing people is not just like, there's some side effects to it that he has to be careful. He can't just unfreeze somebody without any knowledge, because that may end up causing a bigger problem.
Right. I mean, he doesn't necessarily have any idea who these people are before he goes and touches them, right?
Right.
Now, where was the impetus for the story? Where did you guys come up with the idea? Was it on a car ride through Blythe as well, or?
I've actually had this idea for, I want to say, 10, 15 years in the back of my mind. I used to be a computer programmer working in a cube farm, you know, in the insurance industry, which, you know, your mind wanders a lot. And I remember seeing a fellow coworker sitting at his desk and not moving, and thinking, wow, that would, you know, just kind of spurs the mind. And it just kind of took off from there. And I pitched it a couple times to other publishers over the years, but it never quite sank up with what they were doing and the timing and stuff. And, I had an opportunity to pitch to Matt Hawkins, and this was one of the things I threw at him, and he just liked it immediately. And all I know is I pitched it to him on a Saturday. By Monday, they were introducing me to Phil.
So. Nice. Nice. So how did you first hear about the project, Phil?
Yeah, I mean, it followed along that timeline of events. I got a message from Elena Salcedo, who's the editor and runs a lot of things at Top Cow. VP of operations might be her title exact, but she reached out and said, hey, we've got this book that Dan Wickline just pitched to us called The Freeze. Here's what it's about. Are you interested in drawing it? And I was like, that sounds really cool. I sent her some of the recent stuff I had been doing so she could show Dan to see if, you know, he felt that my art fit with the story. And then we were kind of hit the ground running from there. So it was, I kind of came in really early on in the process before I think even a script had been written. So we got to kind of get on the ground floor of the visual design and development of the world.
That's great. So when I first heard about the story, I immediately remembered this old Twilight Zone episode from the Twilight Zone, the 80s version. And, you know, I used to watch it all the time. I probably was around 10 when that show was on air. And, you know, I watched it every week, but there's only like maybe two episodes that still stick with me to this day that I remember just because they're so fascinating. And there's one where a woman digs up this pendant in her necklace in her garden while she's gardening. And it's a little sundial and she puts it on. And what she discovers is if she tells people to shut up or be quiet, everything freezes, like the entire world freezes. And at the end of the story, you know, again, this is mid 1980s, the middle of Cold War, you know, nuclear war was a big fear. There's a report on the radio that the bombs are falling and she yells at the, you know, the radio, shut up. It can't be real. She runs outside and she looks up in the sky and she can see like the missiles coming down and they're frozen and the episode ends, right? So you don't really know what happens. And it was fascinating to me as a kid wondering, she's going to live the rest of her life alone. I mean, it's not quite the same as the freeze, obviously, because everything stops, except for her because she's wearing the necklace. But, that idea of everything being frozen has always fascinated me, and it's part of the reason why when I heard about this, I was like, oh, this is going to be really, really great. And the first issue, as I said, didn't disappoint at all. But I wonder, what are some of the themes that you guys are looking to explore in the story itself?
Well, I looked at my original concept was just following Ray and how people would react. I mean, it's one thing to be the guy that has to go around and make the choices, but to be a person who was frozen, then awoken by this guy, how do you react to him? And there are so many different ways people could react. You get everything from reverence and almost a biblical sense of, you know, is this something from God? Is this a divine intervention type of thing? To people who look at him and think, if I can manipulate him, I can control the world. This is all the power. And, you know, so it's this huge spectrum of how people react to him. And, that's kind of what I want to explore because, I'm also a fan of the old Twilight Zone series. And a lot of times those stories were great because mankind and humanity were the monsters. It was, you know, people's reaction and stuff. So for me, it's really an exploration of humanity at its best and it's at its worst. So that's the themes I want to follow here. And going through all of the different things from the greed to, just how you, you know, like I said, the worst that people can be and also the best. That's kind of what I'm playing with on this. And as I've been writing, my mind starts building more and more ideas on different aspects of this world to play with. So I've got my base idea, but then all these other ideas are coming in as I go along.
Yeah. And it almost seems
like there was
Oh, go ahead, Phil.
I'm sorry. Yeah, there was a Vertigo series years ago called 100 Bullets, which was created and written by Brian Azzarello and drawn by Eduardo Rizzo. And I was a huge fan of that series, especially like the first half. And I think my favorite issues, the best issues of the series, were always ones that really just focused on the morality of the characters involved. The setup was, you know, someone gives you a gun and 100 bullets, and you can do anything you want with them, and you'll never get in trouble. And so the story would always become like, what do people, how do they act and how do they respond to extreme situations? And it allowed, you know, Azzarello and Rizzo to really kind of explore those dark corners of human interactions and impulses and things like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Freeze is a very different book in concept. But what I like about it is it gives us those opportunities to explore those similar ideas, like in extreme circumstances, outside of the normal world, like what are the choices people are going to make and how do those impact others around them? So it's got a fun morality play aspect to the things that we're doing outside of our overall story about people being frozen and rebuilding society.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, we see that right.
As soon as this happens, laws are thrown out the window. It's all, you know, it's a whole new society and the whole new what's right and what's wrong takes over. And that's kind of what you start playing with in this world is, you know, people being driven by their sense of right and wrong and how much of it is based off of laws when the laws are gone. You know, how many things do we not do because we don't want to get caught compared to how many things do we not do because they're not right to do?
Yeah, and we see that right in the first issue when you know, people start waking up and then there comes a point where it's like, okay, hold on a second. We can't just go around. Because first of all, every time you wake somebody up, you got to explain to them, you know, so there's that aspect. And then it's like, yeah, you don't know who people are. You just start going and touching strangers and then what, you know, like what comes next? Like it is that question you have to ask yourself because as I'll call it a tribe, for lack of a better word, you know, as the tribe of the awakened starts to get bigger, then you start to have conflict. You start to have different personalities, and I can only imagine that the ability to wake somebody up all of a sudden becomes the world's most precious resource, and it's clearly limited. So there could easily be a power struggle over, you know, Ray himself, because he's the only one with this ability. So it becomes a fascinating look at building society and almost looking at human evolution again from the beginning in a different way. The infrastructure is there, but all of a sudden you're building a civilization again from the ground up, but with
exactly
with the weapons laying around, right? Guns still work.
Yep.
Weapons still work. So yeah, it's fascinating. And I almost feel like this is kind of incidental to the story being told, much like now that we've gotten so far into The Walking Dead, for example. It's like, well, how did the zombies happen? How did that apocalypse happen? It almost mm-hmm. doesn't matter at this point because it's all about the character and the story. So will we find out how this happened or does it not matter at all to the story? Is it just something that's incidental?
Yes and no. I do plan on telling how it happens, but again, it'll be dictated by how long we get to play in this world. You know, it's not going to be right away. I'm going to give clues, but I've got specifically in my mind, I've got three different endings or three different sources of the freeze. And it's not that I don't necessarily know which one it is, but I'm writing with any of those three is a possibility so that as you're following along, you know, I'll narrow it down as I go, but, it'll be open to stuff like that. So there will be this overall mystery of what happened. But again, The Walking Dead's a great example. You know, my brother is not a fan of horror, but he loves The Walking Dead because it's a survival story.
Yep.
You know, and then the zombies are just, it's almost the zombies are a MacGuffin in the story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're there, they're a threat, but it's about survival. Or the 30 Days of Night movie that came out. When it came out, I watched it and I went, yeah, it's a vampire movie, but this could have been just as easily a war movie about an invading force and the people of an area, you know. So that's kind of how I'm looking at it too, is that the freeze is the impetus and does drive a lot of stuff, but it's more about the people and the reaction to what happened and the fallout from it.
Yeah. Cause honestly, as a storyteller, and both of you can probably speak to this. Once the cat's out of the bag, right? Once we know how it happened, then if the world is not inhabited with interesting characters, then it's like, why keep reading? Right. Okay. So I got my answer of what happened. I'm moving on. Cause what's the point of hanging around? Right. Now, Philip.
Yeah, I mean, and you. No, go ahead.
I was going to say, Philip, from your perspective, as a graphic storyteller, Do you find that to be true in a lot of the story? You know, it's always much more different narrative speaking versus graphically trying to keep a sense of mystery, right? So, you know, we know narratively wise that can happen. You know, once they've got the answer, what's the point? Is it that same way graphically as well, do you feel like? Is there a way to, you know,
Artistically, it's always a fun balance to find ways of taking the information being communicated by the writer and give it something visually interesting. As this book is it's a very character driven book. So the challenge on my end becomes like, all right, how do I make these characters fully realized people? Like, how do we make them, you know, give them a diverse look and give them something distinct and interesting and have the way that they act and speak and interact with people so that as we are, you know, teasing out this information and building this world, there's still a draw and a hook to the best I can of the visual world. And like Dan's saying, if he builds out narratively that mystery in the strongest way possible, as long as I'm doing that on my end too, you're kind of anchored into the book as a whole so that as the reveals come, it's more than just I'm reading this to find out the answer to my question. It's I'm reading this because I care about these people or this aspect's compelling or this, that, and the other thing. There's a lot more than just, you know, can I just get my answer already so I can go home? Like those are the worst types of stories where you only care about, you know, the final word. You don't care about anything else.
Yeah. No capes or tights, but plenty of action, obviously, with the devastation that's happened. But, you know, certainly a political book and you know, the interactions between characters, I feel, is where the payoff can come. So as an artist, is that challenging for you to look at it that way? Or is it more rewarding to be able to tell a story artistically that way and know that you're, like, nailing those character beats and those kind of that emotionality of the story with facial expressions and such?
Yeah, it's a different challenge. I mean, it is really fun to come to be working on Tomb Raider and this book both concurrently, and then to really dive in and finish the series off after I did Tomb Raider. Because with Tomb Raider, you've got Lara Croft and two or three other characters that are distinct and important, but a majority of everything else is just like background stooges and action. And it was a really, really fun book to draw, and I've loved working on Tomb Raider over the years. And then to switch gears with this, where, you know, the cast of characters that I've designed, that we've created, is much, much larger, and everyone has to have their own distinct look and, you know, and ethnicity and body type and way they dress, so that as we move through and navigate, if I do my job right, hopefully, you'll be able to, like, identify who all the characters are, because that's super, super important. So when we have those moments of action or other things going on, they definitely hit home, but at the same point, I think the focus is more on who these people are and how they live and interact with each other. So it's very different, but also a fun way to switch gears and always kind of keep me on my toes and keep sharpening my skills.
Now, Dan, when you first saw Philip's art, what was it about his art that made you feel like he was perfectly suited for this project?
Honestly, it was the way he could can convey emotion and the facial expressions and stuff like that. Because with a character-driven book, you really need the artist to be able to, bring across the emotion of the moment. And what I saw, just, you know, he could do that easily. I mean, it was amazing. And it just fit exactly my vision when I pictured the book. So when Elena sent over his pages, I'm like, yeah, please. You know, take, yes.
Yeah. That's,
I mean,
awesome.
There wasn't a second hesitation. I just knew right away. So
now, Philip mentioned that he came on really early. So once Philip was on the project, did you guys talk about, you know, building the world and how you wanted it to kind of look, you know, look realistic based on the initial, you know, premise? Because as we, you know, we see in the first issue, this event happens. And then, you know, as we start to the world, as far as, you know, physically, geographically, as we start to discover more of it, we're obviously going to see devastation. We're going to see car accidents. We're going to see plane crashes, things like that. Did you two work together? Was there like back and forth on, okay, how exactly do we want the world to look? Because that's going to dictate a lot of the mood and the tone of the story going forward.
We talked a lot about the people, and Phil's very early said, he asked if we could have a very diverse cast, and I was perfectly good with that because that's kind of how I saw it as well. And the whole thing is based in Los Angeles. And when I give him the script, I talk about specific places and stuff like that. So we didn't necessarily talk about how realistic to be, but I'm telling him which buildings that they're in downtown LA. So it seems like he picked up pretty quickly that I was trying to be as realistic as possible.
Yeah, and
with something like this, it was really helpful with that specificity. Every writer writes and sees things differently. So as an artist coming on to a project, regardless of when in the process, I always feel like my responsibility is to try to understand how they're seeing things and then to pick up on those cues and then and do my best to continue to try and elevate that idea. So early on, I know some writers are a little bit hesitant to inundate or to be too specific. And I told Dan, give me as much information as you want, especially when we're starting out, so we can kind of make sure we end up on the same page and then we can get going from there. And he did a great job with each new character he introduced. He would kind of give me an idea, like if I were to cast an actor in this role, this is who it would be. So it would give me a good foundation to build my design from and kind of moving forward.
Yeah. And I think, as spectacular as the kind of the initial conceit is or the initial idea, you do want it to feel grounded. And so, being that it's based in LA, then of course it's got to be diverse. All of us have been to LA numerous times, right? I mean, it is a real melting pot. And so I feel like that's only going to add to, it adds a couple things. It adds a sense of realism, but it also adds a sense of different perspective, right? Based on people's upbringings or cultures. If Ray is waking up, somebody who's, grew up in South America versus Europe versus Africa or things like that, they're going to have different ideas and different reactions to the story that you're trying to tell. Right, Dan?
Yeah, exactly. And not only from where they grew up, but how they were raised. And the first arc gets pretty quickly into that with religious aspects. I mean, if you're born and raised, very much in a religious upbringing, then you're going to take it in that tone, and you're going to see this as a biblical type event, and that plays a part of the first storyline. But also, if you're more of a logical person, or if you're more of a political person. We look at the world today and the diversity and but also the climate that we're in and everybody's against each other type of thing. All that plays into it because that's who we are. So even though the world has changed, people are still who they are coming into it.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to change who you are at the core, no matter how hard you try. People say, people don't change. You grow old and you get sloppy, or you stay sharp, but you don't change.
Yeah. Well, also, I think that people, their beliefs and stuff filter in. So how they see an event, they filter through their previous experiences and their previous beliefs. So it takes on that twist or that bent based on the life they've led. So if you're somebody who has always been the guy out to improve himself and step, don't care who you step on, you just want to get to the top, you're in this whole new world, but you still got that mentality. So you're going to look at Ray and go, okay, if I can manipulate him, or what's in it for me in all this?
Yep.
Those people still exist. You don't change just because the world around you has changed.
Yeah, I mean, I feel bad. I feel bad for Ray, honestly. I mean, he's got this, ability that is, you know, so quintessential to the continued survival of the human race. It's a lot to put on one guy. So I'm really fascinated and can't wait to see the character arc that you guys take him on and see. I mean, I imagine at some point it's got to take a toll on him.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, the whole idea of Ray himself is I wanted somebody with that, the ability to be the everyman. I wanted him to be, Jimmy Stewart. It just shows how old I am, but that type of guy where you're like, you pull for him. He's basically a good, decent person, but he's not necessarily heroic. He's not necessarily evil. He's not necessarily anything. He's still somewhat young. He's still forming his life. He has his attachments to his mom and his dog. You know, that's Ray, and he's still forming who he is. And now the entire weight of the human race has been dropped on his shoulders.
Yeah, it's a lot to carry.
Yeah.
Now you're handling the color work on this book too, Phil. Talk a little bit about that, because I think that longtime comic readers probably know this, but people that are newer to the medium don't realize how much color is part of the tone and the mood of the story. And it really does help with narrative, you know, as you change color palettes based on, you know, the events of the book and the mood that you're trying to set.
Yeah. So when Elena first approached me about the project, I threw out that I would like to be able to color my work on the book. It was something that I had been doing on a couple pitches that year that haven't yet seen the light of day, but it was something I was like, oh, I worked with some incredible colorists, still want to work with more colorists. But at the same time, doing a project every now and then where I can kind of control all the visual aspects of a book is really fun too. So going into it, the first issue took me a lot longer than I had anticipated to do, just part of the challenge of both building a world and characters and then coloring myself for the first time, like on an ongoing project. And it was really fun, but each page was like, all right, what am I doing now?
Yeah.
But the thing that I love most, that I love most in color, and the colorists that I admire, are the kind of tone and mood that they bring to a story. So my biggest challenge approaching each page was like, how do I not automatically fall back into just local colors? And local colors are like, the sky is blue, the grass is green, Superman's cape is red, which is where everything starts. But so many things are affected by the lighting conditions, or especially when you're telling stories, it's about the mood, like how do you want things to feel? So before I even really get into local colors or shading or effects or anything like that, I use like, how are people feeling? What's the mood that I want to elicit as a way to set my base colors and go from there? And by the time I got into coloring issue two, and now I'm almost done drawing issue three, like I've really kind of fallen in love with the ability to kind of play with all aspects of the art. I was inspired by people like Fiona Staples or Mr. Ards or other artists, the few that are doing all aspects of art these days. And someone like Mitch doing it on a pretty much monthly basis is insane. Takes me a little bit longer than 4 weeks to do an issue all myself. But just having kind of that unified artistic vision has been really fun, and I hope people will like it. It looks a little bit different. It's a little bit more expressive than kind of your standard, the big two superhero color book. Yeah, I guess you could say.
Yeah, I love that you mentioned Mitch. You know, he lives here in Phoenix where I live, and we talk color frequently, and we kind of liken it to if you want to look at another medium, you know, movie or television, you know, things on film, and it's the background music that helps set the mood and the tone. And it's something that you know, you're so engaged visually, a lot of times you don't realize that background music is, you know, affecting you. It can cause you to tense up, and it's without even realizing. And I think color in comics does kind of the same thing. So I didn't realize that you were coloring this until I got to the end, and I was like, man, the colors are really good on this. Who did the colors again? I went and looked. I'm like, oh, Phil did them himself. That's awesome. So great job, man. Really, really great job. So let's talk a little bit about the challenge of an independent book like this trying to reach its audience. Obviously, Top Cow does have their fans and somewhat of a following, but this is not... It's not necessarily something that Top Cow is known for. I mean, maybe more so in the recent years, you know, they've done a lot of different things, you know, Think Tank and Tithe and Postal, gotten away from being known for like Witchblade and the whole artifact corner of the universe. But it's still a crowded comic rack out there. So that's always a challenge, right? How do you reach your intended audience? Because I think this book would resonate with a lot of people, but you've got to get it in their hands, right?
Oh, exactly. I mean, and you start out by doing a lot of podcasts. Yeah, I mean, that's the question that's been asked for at least the last 18 years. I mean, ever since the boom and bust of the 90s, people have been trying to figure out how to get their indie books and, you know, attention again and get into those shops who, you know, don't get past the premiere section of the Diamond catalog. So you do your best work and you just get out there and hope word of mouth. And the reaction so far to the concept and to Phil's artwork and his just gorgeous covers and stuff has been so positive that it's a little overwhelming to me, because I've been on a lot of projects and, you know, we get a little buzz here and there, but people seem to really like what they've seen so far. So we're getting a lot of retweets, we're getting a lot of likes and stuff on social media. So we're hoping that's going to help carry us, that people are sharing the idea and, you know, the word of mouth is starting to pick up. But that's pretty much the best way to do it the only way to do it is to get people to talk about the project and get them hooked before it even comes out, because you've got to get retailers willing to buy it. You've got to get, you know, and to get retailers willing to even buy it, you got to get fans talking about it. And so the fact that people seem to be liking what they're seeing really gives me a lot of hope on this project.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think Top Cow has done a really, really great job in the last couple of years in kind of procuring this new brand you were talking about, Jace, with quality books like Postal and the Tide and Think Tank and recent things like Eclipse and Port of Earth and Infinite Dark. And it's advantageous for us in that a lot of these books have done a great job kind of building that foundation for when fans or retailers or other people see a new book coming out from Top Cow that fits in line tonally and quality with some of the other things that they are putting out. It gives them more confidence to order, or fans who are of the other books know that, like, oh, I'm sure I'll like this and pick this up. I think one of the really cool things that Top Cow did is for San Diego Comic-Con this year, they printed up a preview book that previewed both Ryan Katie's Infinite Dark book and then our half of the first issue of The Freeze. So we were giving those out at San Diego. We gave them out in New York. I know Ryan and I and other people have taken stacks of them and brought them to local retailers or sent them back with retailers. We met at shows just as a way to, like, hey, take this and throw it in, you know, the polls or holds of anyone you think would be interested in. And it's been a way to start and get that word out. But yeah, I think, you know, the best way is always if you're excited about something or you're interested in something, to just, you know, open your mouth and share that with the people around you. And that's the best kind of way to build an audience for a new book coming out in a very busy marketplace.
So what I love is that you both mentioned the fact that it starts with a good quality story, right? You've got to do your best work. You both use that term, your best work, because there's so many small publishers out there that are and we know the space is limited and we know the dollars are limited and everybody's fighting to get their thing seen. But what I love about what Top Cow does, so rarely do they, you know, you're not going to see a book from Top Cow that's got like 25 covers, you know, it's not a gimmick. Yeah. It's not some kind of, I don't know, stunt, let's call it, to pull in readers and to try to get them to pay attention to it. It's such a belief, and I think this starts from Mark and Matt and goes down. It starts with the premise that the story, it's got to be a good story. It's got to be a good comic, right? It's got to have a great, it's got to be well written, and it's got to have good art, right? I mean, those are the two fundamentals. And if you do that, you know, it's kind of like, if you build it, they will come. Like, start with that idea rather than starting with some kind of stunt to try to pull readers in, you know, whether that be a 1 in 2,000 cover or whatever. Start with a good story, and that will build the word of mouth. And so I love that that's, and it's part of the reason I support Top Cow so much, is because that's important to us. If we want to keep the comic medium going and pull in new readers, it's got to be quality. It's got to be story first.
Yeah. This issue will actually have a variant cover, but it's not a normal variant. It's not a buy this many, you get it. What they're doing is, Image has done this big push for December of books with covers specifically to raise money for the Hero Initiative.
Oh,
and
nice.
We were honored enough by Top Cow to be chosen as their book for December that's going to get the variant cover. So we have a cover by Rafael Ionco, and it is absolutely gorgeous cover for the first issue that when you buy it, proceeds will go to the Hero Initiative, which is a charity that I've done a lot with and I'm a huge supporter of. And if your readers aren't familiar or listeners aren't familiar with the Hero Initiative, it's a charity that raises money to help support comic creators in need, whether it's medical bills, just regular bills, because there's no retirement fund for freelance. There's no retirement plan for freelance writers and artists. There's no medical groups and stuff like that. There's a risk of being a freelancer, and sometimes we get into points where we need help. And this is an industry-based charity that helps people in the industry. And I've always been a supporter of it. And when they said, hey, we want to do a second cover for the issue to raise money for Hero, I'm like, absolutely, let's do this. So they've got Rafael to do the cover, and it's absolutely gorgeous. So if you're looking for, a way to support the Hero Initiative, there's going to be a whole bunch of covers from different Image books in December. And like I said, we are the one for Top Cow, and we're beyond honored to be that one.
That's awesome. I already pre-ordered the regular cover. I'll have to be sure and pick up the Hero Initiative one as well.
Please.
So based on, Dan, you talked about, it's always based on sales, but you have a lot of ideas in this world. So, do you have the first overall story planned out, but then, based on sales, hopefully it does well. We could see a lot more in this world. And maybe we can go overseas. Maybe we can even, you could possibly bring in other writers to tell a story. I mean, the initial idea is so interesting, right? It just seems like there's any number of unlimited amount of stories you can tell, because at the end of the day, it's about, human interaction and everybody dealing with kind of a whole new world, so to speak.
Exactly. I mean, I look at this as just that. We're basically rebuilding society from scratch. It's the do-over, whether it's the event itself is just the catalyst. Everything after that is where the drama comes from and the story comes from. And, there's so many things that, as I've pitched the story to people or I've been talking to people, they seem to come up with ideas that they're thinking like, oh, well, what would happen if, I had someone that, I was at the LA Comic Con about 2 weekends ago, and I was telling the story to a guy. He goes, so Ray's the only one who can awaken people, but what if he's touching somebody and then they reach over and they touch somebody? Will that awaken them? It's the concept of getting people thinking. And as long as other people are thinking about it, that just shows how furtive this idea can be. So yeah, I mean, I would love to do a lot of books, a lot of stories in this universe would, you know, open it up to other writers, stuff like that, that would be awesome. I would really love that.
Yeah. And what I really am fascinated with is what happens 10 or 15 years down the line. Can Ray pass this on, this ability on to his descendants? What does society look like in 10 or 15 years? Like, it's the possibilities are endless, and it's so fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, it's just anytime I sit down and start thinking about it, or I'm working on the next script, something will pop up like, oh, I should play with this idea. Oh, I should play with that idea. So yeah, I don't see this as being a one and done type thing. I don't see this as, well, here's the story arc. This is a whole new world to play with. And I think it could be a lot of fun. And, you know, so I'm hoping that fans get in there and they buy the first issue and it gets the buzz going. So
yeah, it's gotta be,
I'd love to play in this world for a long time.
It's gotta be a challenge for you as a writer to kind of trim down, right? You're coming up with all these ideas, but you only have so much real estate.
Yeah. And you don't want to give away too much. It's like, we see it on TV over the years. Any romantic comedy that has the two people, like, again, I'm going to date myself here, whether it was Cheers with Sam and Diane, or it was Moonlighting with Bruce Willis's character, and
Cybill Shepherd.
Can't even think of the names.
Cybill Shepherd?
Yeah, Cybill Shepherd. You know, yeah. Those characters, getting them to a relationship, the build up to that relationship was everything to watch. As soon as you got there, the show's all petered out.
Yep.
And that's kind of, you know, so for me, what the freeze was and how it happened is just a tiny part of it. So, I mean, I would love to tell just stories and stories and stories. So, but I've got to give enough to keep people coming back. So it is a tightrope walk to kind of balance that. Like, let me give you just enough to bring you back, but I've got this story over here. So laying in mysteries is going to be how I do that, you know. So it's not just a matter of the one big mystery to solve. There's going to be other smaller mysteries and other things that happen to keep readers coming back. At least I hope.
Well, great. Well, you know, we'll be signal boosting it here over on our Top Cow Thursday episodes, because I think the story is just great. So best of luck with the book. I really want to thank you two for taking the time to chat with me today. Is there anything else you want to share with our listeners, whether it's other titles you have on the stands or something else that you want them to take a look at?
Read Lucius Fogg. They're available on Amazon.
All right. Sounds good. What about you, Philip?
Let's see. It started in January. The trade paperback for Tomb Raider Inferno will be out from Dark Horse, if you want to check that out. Also, Dark Horse is doing a Tomb Raider coloring book, and I did about a third of the illustrations in that one. So that was really fun to do a different kind of coloring book work. My creator-owned books are available on my website. So The House or Paradox, I got digital or digital PDFs or hard copies. If anyone wants to check out something kind of just outside of the realm of what you would normally kind of find on shelves. So that's kind of, and then The Freeze is what I'm busy in for the next couple of months. And then we'll have some news about other projects next year, probably.
All right, great. And if any of our listeners want to follow along on social media, so they'll know when you have new stuff coming out and when issues of Freeze hit, where's the best place to follow you guys?
All my social media is my name. So on Twitter, it's Dan Wickline. On Facebook, it's Dan Wickline. And I have my own website, danwickline.com. So if you remember my name, you can find me.
I'm pretty similar. I got a website at philipstv.com. I've got a store there with books, some original art, print, things like that. And then on Twitter, I'm philipstv, and Instagram and Facebook, I'm philipstv comic art.
Great. And I'll put links to all the social media and both of the websites for Philip and Dan in the show notes, so you guys can find it easily. Go click there. And I do encourage you to go and check out their previous work. So thanks again, guys. Really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today. Best of luck on Freeze. And I can't wait to read issue 2.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having us.